Well, hi and welcome, everybody. I've reviewed the questions and responses you've sent back to my initial queries about what you would most like to focus on and what you'd like to walk away with, and I appreciate that very much. I hope we're beginning to address that. How are you finding the exercises and work tools in the workbook, if you've had or taken a chance to do those along with the presentations and tracking our discussions and the outline as guide for that? Have those been helpful to you in a way to sort of be a catalyst to reflect on some of the initial steps that we've covered? We're going to cover steps 4 and 5 in the roadmap. The first two we've covered. The first three, how to recognize, own, and assess your money story. And we'll pick up with the next two. Any thoughts or reflections or questions about anything that we've covered in the first couple of seminars or about any of those steps as a way to begin to get more subjective and objective awareness of your money story, or at least as a way to guide self-reflection? Any thoughts or questions? Anyone? No?
Hi, David. It's Eric. I'm good. Just
hey, thank
you. There's someone here.
I was getting lonely. Go ahead. any thoughts or questions?
No, I'm good, and I just wanted to pass that on. I'm good to go.
Okay. How are you finding the workbook and the exercises? Is that a helpful adjunct to our discussions?
Absolutely.
Okay. I hope you have a chance to do that and have it parallel pretty much our discussions. And I know you found at the site you were directed to initially where you downloaded the workbook, downloaded the outline, the playback in case there's anything that you missed or you want to go back over. So hopefully putting all of that together and sort of letting it marinate will give you some ideas about at least one way or one system in thinking about understanding and maybe revising or creating a new story. Remember I mentioned that after our last seminar next week, we'll have an extended time for discussion. So any questions, anything you'd like to go over, challenges that you have, we'll take a bit of time at the end for discussion and go over like a quarter hour so that we can address questions and any challenges or applications that you have. So be ready for that, for anything that would be helpful for discussion. Any questions, thoughts, or additions before we move into the material from anyone? Okay, well, I'll move into the material then, and I'll reserve a bit of time at the end for us for discussion, for anything that you'd like to clarify, talk about further, or just add to the hopper for things that we consider and discuss. Okay, we're in presentation mode now, so you don't need to worry about the background noise. Thanks for managing that. So we're talking in this seminar about writing new software. This is steps 4 and 5, to decide what to change and then to map changes of your money story. Remember we talked initially, if you really want to change something, create a habit, change a habit, focus on the system, not just the goal. This is a further emphasis and focus on developing that system. And this system can apply to anything. We're using it to show how it can apply to a money story. So step 4, decide what to change in your money story. I'm going to describe a study and have you guess the biggest change impact and then tell you why I think it's such an important study for us as professional coaches. A few of you may have heard me with this story before, so just hang in there. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, the subjects would choose a different option from pools of contrasting behavior. There were two choices, sort of at opposite ends of the spectrum: lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive, talk about business, talk about sports. They would choose one, and they behaved according to that assignment and choice all day long. So an introverted person would act like an extrovert for the entire day. Additionally, twice a week, they would choose something to eat that they had never eaten before and choose something to read twice a week that they had never read before. So think about it for a minute. What do you think was the biggest change in this group? The remarkable finding actually puzzled the research team because they didn't expect it, didn't predict it, initially didn't understand it. The biggest finding was the subjects lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, almost everyone had kept the weight off and most continued to lose weight. Now, this puzzled them initially because it wasn't a diet. It was a study focusing on change and its impact on choice. The rationale: requiring people to change routine behavior makes them actually think about decisions rather than just habitually choosing a default mode without thinking about it. They became aware that every behavior, everything they ate, was a choice. And they began to reflect on whether that choice was in their best interest. Instead of just starting to eat and watching the show or doing it automatically or eating whatever's on the plate, they looked at it as a choice because they'd been doing that all day long. Most of them came even to recognize that they considered each bite a choice, and they began to ask, is this bite in my best interest? And think about how different that is than sort of unconscious eating. Once becoming aware of actively making choices, you can decide to make the most informed and strategic choice possible. When you think about it, that's exactly what we specialize in as professional coaches: choice architecture. To look at, in a here-and-now way, what's the next best thing to do? And when you think about it, that's all we ever have to do in life, the next best thing. When you do the next best thing, then the next question is, what's the next best thing? Now, remember, your identity is not your behavior or your habits. A habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated, a collection of repetitions. If you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it will make it harder to change. Every action is a choice. Every thought, every feeling is a choice. So let's look just a bit more at choice and choice architecture. Remember last seminar, we discussed the equation: belief drives behavior, behavior drives performance. So for this step in understanding a story, to decide what to change, we're going to add an equation. It captures the principle that whatever we experience, we either create or agree to. When we agree, we give someone else the point of reference. When we create it, we keep the point of reference of our own story. And this is the equation: event plus response equals outcome. Every outcome you experience in life is a result of how you respond to an event in your life. Achievement is an outcome. It's a result of responding in certain ways. We always can't determine what happens to us, but we can determine our response to what happens to us and that often is what makes a significant difference. Remember this essential principle for ownership of your money story. In adulthood, you either create or allow everything that happens to you. You worked out, so now you have more energy and alertness. You didn't attend to marketing, so now your business may be slumping. You've spent more than you earned, so you now have debt. Choice is part of a mindset. The antithesis of choice is also a mindset, and it has its own text. This is how that sounds. Fate, luck, circumstance, bad traffic, things just happen. I can't do anything about it. The absence of awareness of choice can limit possibility. Now, here's a footnote. Whatever you're doing that you can't control or don't control is your addiction. You can be addicted to a substance, a behavior such as spending beyond your means, or to a process such as debt, a certain kind of relationship, or to compromised results. Money is energy. Anyone addicted to anything has difficulty regulating energy and often uses the addictive process or the substance as an attempt to regulate energy. Let's look at obstacles and desires now. This is a notion to consider. What you seek is camouflaged in what you fear. Let me say that a different way. Show me an obstacle, and I'll show you a desire. For example, show me clutter, I'll show you blocked energy that desires release. We always create the outside to match the inside. In other words, rather than strategizing to overcome or avoid or defeat an obstacle, simply consider not creating it. It's there when you create it. Consider using your energy to generate something else instead. A client says, I have this insurmountable problem. You interrupt and ask, what's the possibility here? You focus on something very different than a reiteration of the problem, of the obstacle. Later, it may be more evident about how the problem, the obstacle, is created when you put your energy into something other than creating it. Now, there's a secret here. An obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. I'll let you think about that for a minute. It reminds you of what you want, but it may make it safe to want if you're afraid. For example, I saw a cartoon of a dog straining at his leash, barking ferociously at a cat, as if to say, just let me at him. The next frame showed the cat. The cat was at least as big as a dog, really mean looking, and seemed to be ready for the dog with everything it had. And then, in the next frame, with the dog barking ferociously, let me at him, the leash snapped. So the dog was totally free to go after the cat. He looked back, was astonished, scared to death. He quickly ran back, grabbed the leash, tied a triple knot. Then he could again safely strain at the leash and bark his fiery, just let me at him. Now, here's another example of this dialectic of obstacle and desire. If you view a scene in a film that you don't want to see, you get kind of scared. You cover your face with your hands as if to say, no, I don't want to look. But then the desire creeps in and you peek through your fingers at what you're drawn to see. The obstacle makes looking acceptable. Now, here's the coaching application. When you find yourself focusing on an obstacle, I can't find time to exercise, I can't put away any savings, reflect on the underlying desire. Here's the statement for coaching. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're also ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. Imagine what it would be like not to create your obstacles and focus your energy on your desires and a strategic system to achieve and sustain the success. The primary obstacles that give people, that people give for not participating, say, in a retirement plan include fear of finances, inertia, procrastination, because of other pressing financial demands. Now, the way you frame an issue makes a great deal of difference. We've talked about that. We will return to it again. Here's an example of that effect. When companies automatically enroll their employees in retirement savings plan, the employee then has to opt out to not participate, to make a choice to say, I will not save for my future. When it's automatic, it's 100% initially, then it levels off to between 86 and 94%. At other companies where it isn't automatic, they have to initiate to choose to opt in, 20% participate. A four-fold difference just on the basis of how it's framed. This is a huge non-secret. You can set up your own automatic contributions to automatically deduct a set amount from your checking account to deposit into your retirement account each month. Let's look now at change in the brain. This is, I believe, really crucial to understand when we engage change and facilitate or catalyze our clients changing. Both minds and brains automatically resist change. So let's look at how the brain opposes change and then how to use this information to facilitate success. Four principles to start with. People have prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information. A fact, a belief, is an anatomical reality in someone's brain. You can't just present a new fact or a belief that counters what is already there, whether or not it's conscious, and expect someone to adapt to it. In fact, giving new information that doesn't fit with a system of information or belief that someone has makes them even more likely to find ways to oppose that or refute it. So basically, existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. It's where new learning starts, simply because it can't happen any other way. Two, the prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as neuronal pathways and networks in the brain. Again, facts and beliefs are anatomical realities in the brain. They can't simply be removed or just overwritten by another fact, but they do atrophy with disuse as other strategic networks, systematic networks, take their place. Three, if we ignore reality, in other words, where our client is, what their assumptions and beliefs are, what their challenges are, it will get in the way of new information and change. So as we coach and co-create change, we have to start where the client is, not where we are. And people are not always aware of their prior knowledge. Right now, draw a circle on a page. Inside that circle, draw a stick figure. That stick figure is your client. Outside the circle, that client is really not going to engage or listen very much to you. Your challenge is to get inside the circle. Usually, the best way to do that is an empathic resonance to appreciate the experience, the ways of thinking, feeling, and being of that client, and to find a simple way to say it, just to resonate with their experience. State always comes before strategy and story, so you're resonating with their state of mind. You're looking at how can you best engage the challenge that that client has so that you can then go someplace new together. And four, when changes occur in a systematic and consistent way, new connections are made in the brain. New maps are created. So let's look now at specific ways of how the brain opposes change. The brain has a mind of its own, and we need to consider, in my view, how our brains work in order to strategically plan collaborative change. Each of these precepts will help you craft a new money story and facilitate that for your clients. The mechanisms are a little complex, but the principles are so simple they're almost elusive. One, change generates discomfort. Activities that we've repeated that have become habits become hardwired into the brain. The brain creates a natural network to hardwire things that we repeat so that it can be automatic and energy efficient. Neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by repeated habits to create efficient operation, to make routine behaviors easy. So we don't have to think about the way we drive to work each day. Because of the default mode, we can think about other things or listen to a book. This default mode is energy efficient because it frees up the brain to do other things. When these habits are confronted, though, and have to change, the automatic pilots in the midbrain get disrupted. We feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process this thinking. It's like you drive to work same way every day after 30 or 40 days. You can do it automatically, listen to a book. But one day there's construction, you have to snake your way through a neighborhood, and you can't really pay attention to the book, you have to work at it. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know it yet, so our minds have to lead the way. And it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change to preserve the default habit. And our brains naturally resist change to oppose what's been adaptive from an evolutionary and a practical sense. So some remarkable new research also shows that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expressions. Beliefs can turn genes on or turn them off. Here's a quote from one of my favorite thinkers, Ray Kurzweil, said, and I heard him say this in a presentation. It's also in his book, The Singularity Is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. He said simply, civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. Two of the ways our brains oppose change. Change creates dissonance. We basically see what we expect to see, what our radar has been coded for. In fact, when we don't see what we expect to see, the brain's error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. Our brains have an innate capacity to detect what neuroscientists call errors, which is simply the difference between the automatic wiring of expectation of repetition and something that is perceived that's different than that. It registers as a sense that something's not right. Every one of your clients with every major step ahead, sometimes not so major even, will have this discomfort, this sense of trepidation, anxiety, uncertainty, and their brain's error detection mechanism will say, this isn't right. This is not what I expected. Now, if they interpret that as if it were intuition, such as, well, my intuition says this is not the right thing, they may need some help in recalibrating and determining the difference between intuition and the brain's reading of this isn't what I expected. This discomfort is simply to be framed as a signpost of being in new territory beyond where I was before and an indication of progress and even to proceed. A portion of our medial frontal cortex has the job description to recognize and correct errors. So consider, for example, the emotional expense of debt. The real expense of buying something you can't afford is that you got to pay more for it. Then the emotional experience of your mind and the dissonance in your brain to recognize that spending is different from affording. Then you have to pay the interest. Triple work. You can deceive others, even your own mind, but your brain always knows. The good news now, this neuromachinery can both recognize and correct errors to optimize behavior by responding to mistakes. Now, this is great when we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or a neural response to change itself in the discomfort of doing something new, even when it's exciting and adaptive. 3, the brain is a prediction machine. Here's a brief exercise. If you have a pen, let me tell you some numbers. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, 8. What's missing? If you look at it, maybe 3 and 6, multiples of 3. Consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, so the brain predicts a 3rd rise will follow. Here's an example. A company has increased profits 26 quarters in a row, with projected earnings going to 24 cents per share in this current quarter from what they've done before. They announce earnings instead of the predicted 24 cents of 23 cents a share. In the next 5 minutes, they lose $1.5 billion in market share. In those 5 minutes, what changed? The company's intrinsic value and balance sheet? No. 1 penny difference in earnings based on the prediction of some people that may not have done their homework. Or was it the mindset of the investors? J. Paul Getty said there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Wake up early, work hard, find oil. Now, you can see how the brain predictions a pattern is also the basis of jokes. Listing 2 things in a 3rd non-sequitur, set up, payoff. Our brains automatically impose patterns and predictions on repeated events. This can make it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns at times to make a wise and balanced decision. So we need to be sure we predict, even envision, the right things. 4. Behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. Which do you think works better, threats or reinforcements? Well, the answer is neither. Both will likely backfire. Studies show 2 things. Threats work short-term but draw attention away from work and back to the problem that created the behavior. And recognition for someone being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. Both are a focus on the negative. Playing to win always works better than playing not to lose. We know this from performance science. We assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. Not so to any one of you who have ever seen 1 client. You know that's not true. In fact, if someone is told what to do, this can result in an innate opposition because the brain is pushing back. This is why it doesn't work very well at all to give instructions, directives, to tell what somebody does or solve problems. The brain's natural homeostasis says, avoid change. 5 of how the brain opposes change. motivation is not essential. How many times have you heard somebody say, those of you in coach training, when you do a coach-to-coach, the client begins, I just need to get motivated to save money, or I need to get motivated to work out or to eat a healthier diet. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. And someone may not generate motivation until they develop a system and a goal. I've worked with a number of professional athletes. They are not motivated in the off season to get up and go to the gym. But they do because they know that that's what they have to do in order to do what's next. Same thing with actors. Motivation isn't essential. There are only two things that are essential. Having a plan, a system, and sticking to it. And, again, back to this, you don't have to be motivated to save for retirement. Just set up a simple participation plan, an automatic payment. That's a decision you make one time. It's done automatically every month from now on. You just need a plan to stick to it. You only need to make a good choice, in this instance, one time. The quality of many future years can be affected. 6, emotions change brain function. When emotions are triggered, brain chemicals of dopamine and adrenaline are released that prompt toward action and away from both creativity and assessing and reflecting on a situation or knowledge. This is why self-talk can be limited. It may work until emotion gets activated. As soon as an emotion is triggered, reason runs and logic leaves. The philosopher Mike Tyson said, everybody's got a plan until they're punched in the mouth. When there is possibility of a reward, dopamine is released to produce an excited state, a chemical of pleasure, in response to anticipating that reward. Here, that it's not in response to doing something, it's in response to anticipating a reward. It's not the reward that causes the spike in dopamine. When gamblers were studied, for instance, their increased brain firing and dopamine spike occurred just before they touched the slot machine. When somebody makes a purchase, that dopamine hits as they anticipate and are about to make the purchase. When someone makes a purchase, what happens? It moves to a different system, the norepinephrine system, that's about maintenance. That's not nearly as exciting. So the reading may be, what happened? I was expecting this to be really exciting, all the way to buyer's remorse for something that's been long anticipated. Now also, the less predictable a reward is, the longer and stronger the dopamine neurons fire, creating more of a natural high. So this is something that is to be considered. Laboratory mice tell us this. A bank of slot machines in Vegas tell us this. You see the same scenario complete with lever pulling and reward pellets. The moral. People can fall into an unconscious pursuit of dopamine and its accompanying pleasure despite an illogical downside. 7, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, known as a little bit of stress, can enhance memory and learning. The things that excite us provide a little bit of stress short-term, enhance learning and performance, but the time window is up to about 2 hours, especially for cognitive performance. For longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, things go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. This means that sustained stress can lead to bad and emotionally charged decisions. The most important success strategy for most of the people leading the way executives I've worked with is the regulation of states of mind and management of emotions. In fact, a couple of studies recently in Scientific American Mind and Harvard Business Review have shown that the most important success factor in executives is the ability to self-reflect and regulate states of mind, because that frames the best decisions. Now, I think that's the case because that's the only people they studied, executives. I believe that's the case for everyone, for every one of our clients. 8, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people can close themselves to novelty as they get older. Now, the major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place, in one position, get most entrenched. Their brains get hardwired for what they do, and they repeat this. An example, a place I see this kind of entrenchment and resistance in coaching is family succession of business. A patriarch founder passes the company he founded 32 years ago to his two children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles, relationships, and functioning. Now, these last two principles, I believe, are huge in strategic coaching and in what we do in catalyzing change. 9, neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. Two things above all others have shown to create neurogenesis: an enriched environment and exercise. Think about an enriched environment. Intellectual, emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure to create, to co-create, to stimulate thinking, to challenge, to story bust. What we do every day with our clients. The hippocampus is the part of the brain especially connected with creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. Now, what's your guess about how much exercise increases the number of cells in the hippocampus? 100% increase. Now, these findings were recently replicated in non-invasive human studies in London taxicab drivers and University of Hamburg medical students. And remember, the hippocampus especially connected with creativity and memory. Another finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. So both creativity and memory go the other direction with chronic stress. And 10, neuroplasticity simply means that the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job description of neurons, rezoning and developing cortical real estate. Here's a simple example. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they had a headgear with a visual apparatus that exactly reversed everything they saw. What was up became down 24 hours a day. Everything was reversed consistently. They had to learn to adjust everything they did, to move very carefully, to think through everything they did, every movement. Then they noticed about day 25 for each, their brains automatically made the adjustments. They didn't have to anymore. The brains had developed new neural pathways, had rewired to make a normal image. Now, another group of astronauts in the headgear were given a day off out of the helmets for 24 hours at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them from that point forward 25 days to make the adjustments. That says something about consistency of change. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains as well. Step 5, map changes. A man approached, this is a true story, J.P. Morgan, held up an envelope and said, "Sir, in my hand, I hold a guaranteed formula for success, which I'll gladly sell you for $25,000. That was back when $25,000 really meant a lot. Now, $7 means a lot to me now, but still. Sir, J.P. Morgan said, I do not know what's in the envelope. However, if you show it to me and I like it, I give you my word as a gentleman, I'll pay you what you ask. Well, the guy agreed to the terms. What's he going to do? He handed over the envelope. J.P. Morgan opened it, extracted a single piece of paper, gave it one look, and then handed the piece of paper back to the man and wrote him a check for $25,000. There were two sentences on the page. Every morning, write a list of things that need to be done that day. Do them. Now, there are six crucial elements to map change. We'll talk about how to understand and incorporate each of these six. This is an outline, a system to master your money story. One, regulate states of mind. This is important to create a framework of how we process everything else that we do. States of mind are like software programs. They're a mind-body state that determine how we perceive and process information and how we respond. We each have different states of mind: relaxation, alertness, anxiety, anger, centered attention. Every state, every software program determines what's taken in, what's perceived, what's taken in as input, and then once input, how it's processed. It's internally consistent, but it's a different software program. So a key element is to be aware of our different states of mind, to know which state works best for what purpose. For example, creative writing and editing. Two different states of mind, two different parts of the brain. Brainstorming versus completing a project. Important to protect and preserve, to enter the state of mind is going to be optimum for a particular performance. When someone's in an emotional state, they're overbalanced toward right brain response, the feeling brain. In extreme stress, the emotional brain can even hijack the intellectual logical brain and hold it hostage. So what do? If your brain is working against you, when you're in any state of upset or anything that is off-center in any way, the first order of business is to regulate feelings to restore a cool state, a balance of left and right brain. In other words, to get grounded and centered. A mindfulness meditation is a great way to do this. It's an example of focusing on one thing, on your breath. Breathing in for relaxation, breathing out any tension. If you have a thought, you don't engage it. You let it float away and you refocus on your breath. Poker players call this tilt. When you lose big or win big, you're in an emotional state and inclined to play your last hand or your leftover emotion. So the important thing here again is to get grounded and centered. Then you can respond when your state of mind is balanced. The number two element to map changes, the power is in the focus. This is the neuroscience and quantum physics behind the law of attraction. Thoughts have a frequency, an energy field. Focus selects that frequency. All the channels of a radio or satellite TV are available. We choose the channel, the frequency we want, out of hundreds of possibilities. If you want to change something in your life, change the frequency, the channel. Change your thoughts. Now, the bad news, if you think about what you don't want, it keeps showing up over and over. We get what we focus on, not what we want. According to quantum physics, we each generate energy frequencies or vibrations. We project energy in our emotions and thoughts that are the source of what and who we attract, as well as the basis of our sense of well-being. The quantum Zeno, Z-E-N-O effect says, the mental act of attention, sustained attention, activates and holds in place brain circuitry. With consistent focus and repetition, these chemical links actually become stable changes in the brain structure. The brain rewires. Dr. Jeffrey Swartz at UCLA was a guest of mine in a mastermind group. He has described and illuminated so much about the quantum Zeno effect. Now, quantum physics offers us still another paradigm. In addition to our individual energy field, there's a collective field. And you can tap into and resonate with this field, the quantum field of possibility. Einstein called it the unified field theory. He basically said that our individual mind and body is a bundle of energy that interacts with another person's energy field, which is the source of, among other things, intuition, as well as the collective energy field of a group. This is how we can read people, focus our choices, determine the flow of our future. Think about what I consider a natural experiment for this. The NBA has 84 games a year, 42 away, 42 at home. Every team in each conference loses about twice as many games away as they do at home. When they're away, there are pre- and post-COVID 80,000 people, most of whom have a negative energy field for the visiting team and a positive energy field for the home team. So, what do you do to tap into this collective field? We project energy frequencies and, like a magnet, attract what we focus on. If we focus on the negative and on problems, that'll be what we create. It boots up a mindset. If we focus on the positive and on solutions, that'll be what we create. So, looking at a problem boots up instantly a problem mindset. Looking at possibilities, which is exactly what we ask about in coaching, boots up a mindset of possibility that then can generate new neuronal connections and pathways in the brain, as opposed to going down an already existing problem pathway. And every time you go down it, even ostensibly to come up with better solutions, it etches it a bit further, which is how people get stuck in therapy. We touched on that. So, the paradox is we don't attract what we want, we attract what we focus on. So, think about the power of focus. Whatever you attend to or focus on, you align your energy field to create that. So, be sure you focus on the right thing. Here are some bad examples. I want to get out of debt. Who focuses on debt? I want to lose weight. Focus on overweight. Here's one that's kept a lot of dry cleaners busy. I want to be really careful and not spill anything on this new outfit. 3, visualize changes. A prototype study was at Ohio State University where basketball players were divided into 3 groups to practice shooting free throws. One group, no practice for a month. Other group, 30 minutes of practice daily at free throws. Third group, they practiced imagining shooting free throws, nothing but net, for at least 5 minutes daily for 30 days. They were tested at the end of 30 days. First group, no practice, no improvement. Second group, actual practice for 30 minutes, 24% improvement. Third group, visualization only, 23% improvement. Now, we have perfected this more so that there actually can be more of a positive change with visualization only, because every time you miss, you have to correct. And it's not that practice makes perfect, because you can groove the wrong habit. Perfect practice makes perfect performance. On brain imaging, the same sequence of firing occurs with visualization as with actually shooting. So create an image of your goal and your success in reaching it and live into it. Visualization crystallizes possibility and articulated ideas. The experience changes the brain. And a vision serves as guide and inspiration to design ways to realize it, to live into it. 4, insight changes the brain. At the moment of insight, an aha experience, 3 different parts of the brain light up on fMRI scans, and someone is vaulted into a more creative and synthetic state of mind. When someone's given information, a directive, an order, a group of facts, nothing happens. Now, as important as this insight-induced change is, the sustained attention and the system of implementation is what hardwires it into the brain circuit and into achievement. 5, take action. The world will not pay you for what you know. It'll pay you for what you do. It rewards action. To analyze and plan are important. Payday comes with action. Winners develop a plan and set it into motion. It may not be perfect, but you can proceed organically, self-correct, keep moving forward, learn from mistakes, and produce results. This may be why a group of the brightest people anywhere with all kinds of degrees can plan and figure something out, but struggle to make it happen. I was on the board of directors of a group like that for a startup company once. Absolutely fantastic degrees and background. Meanwhile, the guy who almost finished the second semester of the first year of community college owns a bunch of real estate on the west side of town. And 7, transform identity. This we're going to talk about more in next week's seminar. A new experience or idea must be focused on consistently and frequently in order to incorporate, to transform behavior into an operating model of how and who you are, in order to transform identity. We always return to our identity. So if we behave in a different way, but don't transform it for it to become part of our identity, we'll revert back to the previous behavior. When it's incorporated as part of who we really are, then we're consistent with it because we always return to who we really are. So this needs attention by us with our clients in terms of transformation, not of just behavior and strategy, but also of identity. We can talk some more about that in a discussion. Here's an application in summary of steps 4 and 5 to decide and map change. Let's apply it to your debt story. And I recommend doing the 3 exercises under debt story in step 5, beginning, I think it's page 5.10. You can fulfill a desire you didn't know you had by spending money you don't have. You can define yourself by acquisitions not paid for. You can even borrow based on how much money you'll be lent rather than how much money you can pay back. Spending money generates the perception, both by the spender and the observer, of having money. Fulfilling a wish creates a desire. When desires define identity, it can become unrelenting. Many people who fall heavily into debt don't necessarily have psychological problems, but because spending takes on a life of its own. With spending, the chase is on. They try to afford what they can buy, and money can never buy what it represents emotionally. The very first client I had, someone who I had collaborated with, had no idea this was going on, had waited until I was ready to begin coaching as a professional coach. And into the process, it took about 3 or 4 months for her to finally admit, because it was so wrapped in shame, that she had over $500,000 in debt that her husband knew absolutely nothing about. And she was a specialist in the money financial arena. It may be hard to say because of the way our minds work and our brains are wired. It's hard to resist the immediate pleasure of buying. It activates the same pleasure center that produces dopamine. Spending money is addictive. It changes the state of mind. And it's difficult to substitute an abstract idea, a theory, such as a future need, long-term saving, retirement, for an immediate bright and shiny. The most common way we're short-sighted in our decision-making is that we may choose a small amount of something right now rather than a larger amount in the future. So here are some possibilities of different ways to think about this. Neuroeconomist Ben Seymour at the University College in London has shown that imagining a future purchase has the same effect in the brain as getting it. We know that from visualization. Saving is easier when it's for something specific that we can envision. It's easier and more specific, for example, to create a distinct vision for each goal, such as a vacation a college tuition, a new house. Tangibly calculate the cost of debt so that it becomes real figures. I'm going to give you an example, an illustration here, to concretely represent the, in the other direction, the magic of compound interest. Figure out what money you spend, for example, what it would be worth in 5 years, in 10 years, at retirement. Here's an example. If you invest $1.50 a day beginning at age 20, and based on the stock market average growth since 1926, by age 65, it'll be worth $1 million. You wait until age 21 instead of 20, the difference is $109,000. Another scenario, if you invest $2,000 a year in an IRA beginning at age 18, then stop all investment by age 30, by age 65, it'll be worth $1 million. Credit cards segment the pleasure of spending from the pain of future payment. When we spend or anticipate spending, there's a dopamine hit. When there's the pain of payment, it activates a totally different part of our brain, the pain center. And we separate that by spending now and saying, I'll have more next month, I'll pay next month. So those two are segmented. Rationalization heightens in proportion to elastic boundaries. A recent economic study showed that credit card holders are consciously aware of only $4 of every $10 they owe, actually unaware of that $6. This underestimation is a form of denial. Debt has been called a secret sin because of the shame attached. Remember, I mentioned, I think it was last time, that people spend 23% more when they use a credit card versus cash or check. Here's a brief story to end. This is what one expert had to say about debt. Uncle Junior to his nephew, Tony Soprano. You know, your father and me started that poker game over 30 years ago. We were talking one day about how the credit card companies, you know, they work their angle. They don't care what you bought as long as you don't pay all at once. They juice you to death, and you thank them for letting you have a card. You'd rather be juiced than pay all at once. It's a certain kind of player. That's why we call it the executive game. We render money in abstraction and deceive ourselves. Well, I can do it on my credit card so it will not be an immediate expense. And as Richard Medley said, free money makes you stupid. And remember this, a final sentence here, two sentences. Remember this from everything you've just heard. Right now, saving and the future are both abstractions. There will be a time when they both become very real. We really have only a minute or two, and I thought we'd have a bunch more. Any comments or thoughts or questions about anything we've talked about? I hope this is making sense to you. Any clarification?
It's making great sense. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Anything you'd like to ask or clarify about anything we've talked about? I'd encourage you to do a couple of things before our final seminar. Catch up in the workbook and doing the exercises and work tools on you for you, and then jot down any challenge, any vignette, any questions you have about anything we've talked about or you'd like to talk about further in our period of extended discussion at the end of next seminar. So take good care of yourselves. I look forward to picking up right here and doing our final seminar together. Thanks so much, and thanks again for all the questions, the reflections, and things that you've sent in an email. And if you have more, fire them away. Thanks very much. Have a great, great week.
Hey, thanks, Dave.
See you guys. You bet.